Yeah. Yeah. Di tingkat Mazika. Sasu dance my country. Me and you, we are Sasu Denise. You're my country brother. She's my country sister. We got no boundaries between us. We've been living side by side for all of these decades. Do you understand?
This is a song by a local band called G Dinkas. Yeah. The front man, Dominic Leek, is a lost boy of Sudan. That's a term that refers to thousands of children displaced by the Second Sudanese Civil War. Dominic left his home village in 1986, and the struggles he left behind are a big part of his music, as you can hear in this song. It's called We Are One People. Let's listen.
Yeah, we'll be living side by side for all of these decades. Say I walk, you walk, and that's how we get ahead. But you get to understand, we need each other. Love your neighbor just like you love yourself. Be loyal to your nation just like you're loyal to your wife. Let us have a better communication so we can fix our issues. Stop fix things, South Sudan belong to all of us. Stop listening to those talking heads. Wear your own shoes, do your own balls. Put your country first and love every people. Ask questions so you can have a better understanding. Don't follow nobody when they're making wrong decisions. Music is in my blood, I'm South Sudanese. I sing and rap and that's what I like to do. Fans scream and yell when they see me on the stage. You got to know how to play ball so you can be in the game. If your game ain't tight and nobody pay attention, G-Dinkas ball, he's the game that we play, yeah.
This is We Are One People by G-Dinkas. The band's releasing a new album this weekend, so we're taking the opportunity to hear about Dominic Leek's story of making a home in Kansas City after fleeing a civil war. I'm Gina Kaufman. Good morning, Dominic.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm happy to be here today. How you doing?
I'm pretty good. You know, I mean, so we're hearing this song about, with a really hopeful message, you know, this idea of we are one people. It is quite a message for a country still ravaged by conflict. The aid chief for the UN recently called the suffering in South Sudan unimaginable.
You know, South Sudan have a lot of potential, and South Sudanese people are a blessed people, and a lot of people been standing with them to help them. And what is happening is heartbreaking, and we were not expecting, you know. And I'm really thankful that United States been standing with us for all these years. So I'm grateful that they still standing with us, and there is nothing that cannot be solved. So they will figure out a way to get out of this problem.
Can you tell me about the Sudan you grew up in?
The Sudan that I grew up in was a country that forced me to leave and denied me the access to school, the opportunity for jobs, and there is no roads, there is no development. They deny me, and that's why there was a civil war, because people were mistreated.
Can you explain what that felt like to you as a child?
Back then, I couldn't understand it. But I know it was a problem because the houses were burned down, the cattle were taken, the food that we eat was destroyed, so that we can be vulnerable, so we can go back to the city because we live in the villages. But it didn't happen, thanks God. You know, the other countries like United States, Canada, Australia, they step in and help, and that's how I got out of my country.
What was your childhood like, just everyday life with your family?
I really didn't have enough time to spend with my family. On that part, my childhood life, I did not enjoy it because I was on rent, hiding and looking for help. And so when you talk about child growing up in their country with families, I did not have that opportunity.
So you don't see it as a childhood with a family. You see it as a whole different kind of a childhood.
Yes, a child that worry about like where he can, what he can eat when he go to sleep, where he can sleep at, no shoes, no water, no hope.
What happened in your village that was sort of the breaking point for you?
What happened, it was a political thing. And back then I did not know, but they came as a group. They shoot each and everyone. They burn the houses. So what you do at that point, you have to run to hide. If you lucky you didn't get shot, then you run. And so when that happened, I just ran. And that's how I was separated with my parents. My dad was killed in the war. And when I came to the United States, that's when I learned my mom is still there. Some of my siblings were killed. So I ran my own way.
And you just ran?
I just ran.
There was shooting and you ran?
Yeah, I ran.
This is during the Second Sudanese War that started in 1983, is that right?
Yes.
So what was your understanding of the conflict at the time? And I guess what is your understanding of what was going on now that you're an adult with some distance from it?
In my understanding now was that we were denied the right of everything. And my understanding of that war was they were fighting for my independence. They were fighting to equal right. They were fighting so we can have schools, hospitals.
And we is South Sudanese?
South Sudanese.
Can you explain the two sort of warring factions, like who they are, what the conflict is even about?
You know, I'm from South of Sudan, and there is Northern Sudan. The bigger problems in Sudan back then, they were denying Southerners to their rights, like Christianity. They want Sudan to be Muslim country. We say no. We are Africans. We are Black African, and we welcome you guys to come to the land. So for the whole country to be Muslim country is not acceptable. So that's what caused the war, and we were resisting for us to be transformed to be Muslim, to the whole country be Muslim. So we deny that.
So it was in some ways a conflict over conversion.
Yes.
Tell me about the journey. I mean, so you hear shooting and you run. Do you remember what happened next after that?
After I ran, and I went and met a lot of other people that were displacing their places, I was lucky enough, I met my uncle, who run his own way, and we start working, going neighbor's countries.
You and your uncle?
Yeah, my uncle, because I was too young to work that distance. So the distance from my hometown to like Ethiopia, it was like 3 months.
A three-month journey on foot,
yes,
from South Sudan to Ethiopia.
Yes.
And how old were you?
I was six when I left my country.
So how did your uncle, did your uncle carry you?
Yeah, he carried me in his bag.
Wow. What, do you remember, like, sleeping arrangements? 3 months is...
You know, because we were, back then, Sudan government was in different towns. So what you do, you walk in the bush in the night. Then in the day, you hide. Because if you walk in the day, they can see you and you can get killed. So my uncle carried me in his bag in the night. And then in the day, we sleep under the tree.
You know, that's really an intense experience for an eight-year-old to have. Do you remember how your eight-year-old mind coped with that?
Really, I didn't even know what it was. So they said it was a fight. I couldn't feel it, but I do see what happened. But after I grew up, yes, it affected me a lot.
When this term, like, lost boys, mm-hmm. What does it mean to you?
What it means it's my history. It means I was separated with my parents. It means I didn't have my childhood or the country that I was born in. All my young generations were killed. Some died because of anger. Some died because of diseases. Some didn't have no opportunity to meet their mom. Their mom was killed in the war.
Is that something like that term? Do you identify with that term as part of a larger community here in Kansas City, here in the United States, even globally?
Yes. Yes. We are a family, because that history will never change. It will never go away. And and become part of who we are.
When you got to Ethiopia, I mean, you traveled for 3 months on your uncle's back mostly, but then it was still 4 years before you got to Kansas City. What was the rest of that journey?
The journey, just to break it down, when I left my home in 1986, it took me 3 months to go to Ethiopia. And then when we reached Ethiopia, it was 4 years later when the Ethiopian Civil War broke out. And the person who was in charge, who took over the power, didn't like us. He didn't want us in Ethiopia. So in 91, we have to leave the country, come back to Sudan, following the border toward Kenya. So I made it to Kenya, 1992, and there was a lot of refugees. So most of my fellow Lost Boys, we worked from Ethiopia again to Sudan. Then we crossed the border town. We went to Kenya in 92.
By then you've been traveling for a couple years.
Yes.
You're coming of age during that time. I mean, you're going from being a child to being a preteen, and you're doing it in this sort of, I don't know, like you're on the go and you're not settled. Do you remember that experience?
It's not pretty. The experience is really for a child like me or my age to be in that situation in the first place. You don't understand it. And then when you talk to adults, they don't explain it. They don't have no answers. So all you do is like just leave it. You just leave it. If you die that day, that is the end of the world for you. But if you make it to next day, that's all you need. You know what I'm saying? But it was...
Wait, I don't... Because, I mean, this is really like such a different experience from my own. And you went to sleep at night. I mean, every day you thought, I might die today. You thought that thought consciously?
Mm-hmm. Because there is war everywhere. There is gun everywhere. You know, you don't really, there is no security whereby you guarantee your life. Anything can happen anytime.
So how did you end up in Kansas City?
Kansas City, after we came to Kenya in 1992, the United States came to our camps where we were living, young boys living by themselves and girls. And there was this question being asked, why have these boys been working all these years and living by themselves?
The international community had not yet asked that question?
They never asked that, but U.S. was asking. So by then, we went to school. We have a little English, but it's not that perfect. So we told them, when the war broke out, we were taken to Ethiopia. And some of us don't have mothers. We are the mothers, we are the fathers.
You're your own mothers and your own fathers?
Yeah, we cook for ourselves and we make
turns. How did you do it? How did you cook for yourself? How did you get the food?
From the UN. We get the food from the UN, United Nations. So they, like, you know, every 2 weeks you get a certain amount of food. But you have to wait that one until the month ends. So what we do is, like, we are five in my household, and we make turns. So if it is my turn today to cook, then I cook for everybody, get the water for everybody. And then tomorrow is going to be the 10th for the next guy, just like that. But if I fall sick, they're the one to take me to the hospital. So that's how we grew up.
And that was all kids, five kids in your household?
Yes.
How did you form your household on your own, or was that part of, like, you were assigned?
Yeah, when we came to Kenya in 92, the UN gave us the shelters, but you have to build your own. All they give you, the plastic, the wood, and then you get the mud and all of that to build your own. And that's where you restore your food, your water, your belonging.
How old were you by this point?
By that point, I was... 4 years, 6, 10, I was about 12, 15 years.
Man, so you go from this situation to eventually being able to come to Kansas City?
Yes, after that, the UN, the United States of America said, you know, we're going to have you guys. And that's when they start doing the process of how to get us here so we can go to schools, so we can be united with our parents, if there is a mean.
What was that process like for you to suddenly have someone intervening and showing you a path toward getting an education and possibly reuniting with whatever family they could reunite you with?
There was a process set up by the UN. Just like you interviewing me today, you ask me some question. So they make your day, they put the date on the board, and you have to come to the office. They interview you. Why are you here? Why are you staying by yourself? What can we do to help you? How old were you? Stuff like that. And after they interview you, they ask you, if you come to United States, if we take you to United States to give you education and all of that, would you accept it? We say yes. Any help we can get, so we can put the story and the tragic situation our people are in. So they ask us some questions, and that's how we came. Some didn't make it because they did not pass the test.
I'm talking with Dominic Leake. He's with a band called G Dinkus that's here in Kansas City and releasing a new album soon. And he's remembering his experience as a lost boy of Sudan, fleeing civil war in his home country and eventually arriving here in Kansas City. What was it like for you to arrive in Kansas City? I mean, do you remember the first days after you arrived here?
I remember when I came, there were American friends and South Sudanese who were designated to pick us off in the airport. And I remember that day, it was lovely. We were warmly received. And then we have also American friends who were volunteer to show us how to cook, how to drive, how to cross the road. By then we don't know how to drive or nothing like that, how to catch a bus, you know, stuff like that. So it was very different experience. And yes, I remember it was lovely, and I was so excited to come to Kansas City.
Did you ever get homesick, or was that just, is that an inconceivable thing considering what you'd left behind? Was there anything that you'd left behind that you sort of ached for sometimes?
Matter of fact, that's what forced me to sing, to be the singer. I miss my mom, I miss my dad, I miss my siblings, right? And with that situation that I was in, millions of other lost boys went through it. And that's why you see some of them right now, some are ending up being in jail. Some are drug addicts. But me, I choose not to be drug addicted or alcoholic. I choose to write a song so I can sing it to relieve myself. But, you know, every night I have a nightmare, but I wake up and turn it to be a song.
So had you made music before that? Had that been part of your experience, or was this part of how you got your, was the arrival of music in your life part of getting through this transition into life in Kansas City?
Before I wasn't, but the situation I was in, yeah, kind of forced me to.
So how did the sort of nightmares that became music, how did that work? They were songs in your head. How did that become songs that other people could also hear?
You see, sometime in your life, what happened to me, it was a transition from war to a peaceful mindset. So America gave me the freedom to think free, to walk free, or do something that can help me or help others. So first, what came in my mind is like, okay, America helped me. What can I do to appreciate or give back for the help that they gave me? And for that, if I had to go knock the doors and thank them, it wouldn't be enough. So what I did was, you know what, for Americans to know the help that they gave to me and my fellow lost boys and South Sudanese in general was appreciated. And so I decided to write a song so I can tell them that lost boy that you guys help is thanking the whole nation. And that's why that was one of my goal. And that's what made me to be a musician. And then on top of that, the struggles and all the bad stuff that happened to me, it become a part of the foundation of what I was trying to do.
You had to also, like you were saying, learn a lot of new things in Kansas City, how to catch a bus, how to cook food, how to drive a car. But what about school? I mean, you have this whole long period of your life where you hadn't been able to go to school. Were you able to catch up in your education?
We tried to catch up, but, you know, it was very hard. It was very, very difficult, but with that difficulty, we have American volunteers who make it easy for us to go to schools, for instance, to apply for financial aid or, you know, stuff like that. Some even, like, you know, they help pay our debt. You know, you remember when we came here, you have to have a ticket. So those money were paid by American volunteers who see it like, you know, we cannot afford at that moment to pay back the debt.
Tell me about making friends and getting to know people here and just, yeah, like you're sitting in front of me, a grown person with a music career and all of this. How did you get your footing really beyond these basic things you're talking about?
Going to school, they show me procedures of if you want to represent something or talk to somebody, this is how you approach, this is how you communicate. So I took some speech classes. The school teach me how to respect, because you cannot do anything if you don't have no respect or you don't appreciate others. So I learned all of that through schools and through my American friend that I met in schools and off the schools. Could be at work, my co-worker, you know. So not me alone, all my lost boys, that's how we succeeded in Kansas City. I don't know about the other cities.
When you started making music, can you talk to me about the first song that came to you? Do you remember the first song that came to you? You were saying that the songs originally came to you as you were sort of emerging from nightmares.
Mm-hmm. The first song was The Destruction of Our Home. And that song was called Young Panda. The Destruction of My Home, that was the title. And what I described is what I saw at that early age when the war broke out. And that song, when we composed that, he went viral. And that's what we were known for up to today. So that's the first song.
When you say it went viral, I mean, was it other people who had shared your experience around the world who heard it and had similar memories?
Yes. And that's why the song take off. Because what we describe over there is what happened to each and every South Sudanese that was in that country.
Can you share this song, it sounds like it's not in English. Can you share with our listeners some of what they would hear if they could listen to the song and understand the words?
Basically, what the song was talking about, the Young Panda, mean in English, the destruction of my home village. It's talking basically, what is it that I did? If we were the same people living in that country, why would you target me and take all my belonging? And now I don't have no home. I have to move from place to place. And every time I go to this country, there is a problem. So when I went to Ethiopia, I thought I'd find a second home. It didn't happen. I was chased away again in 91 until I made it to Kenya. So the only country that gave me the peace of mind is when I came to the United States. So all the countries that I've been going to, that's what I describe in my song, and a lot of people went through that too. So
when you say that the song went viral, I'm guessing that was sort of an online community of people and a response online. Did you connect with a lot of the people who heard the song and could relate to it?
Yes. And you see the callers, when the song came out, we went different state and different communities. And you see what happened too, it was during a referendum, South Sudanese referendum. So the song related to them and it can energize them to vote for what they want. And that was during a referendum for South Sudan.
Some of your songs are in English, but a lot of them are in another language. What is the language?
Dinka. It's the Dinka language.
And that's why your band is called G-Dinka?
G-Dinka, because majority of the group members were from that tribe.
You've got a new album coming out this weekend, which is super exciting, and I'd like to listen to a song, but as we've discussed, a lot of our listeners won't understand the lyrics. Can you tell us what this song is about before we crank up the volume?
This song is calling, is saying, Paniam, mean new home. After we voted for independent, South Sudan become independent nation, and now I can call it my home. And that's what the title of the song, and that's going to be the title of the album. It's called Paniam, New Home.
We're going to listen to it now. You know, this is about the idea of Sudan, South Sudan, feeling like a home again to you. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
You see, when we were fighting, we didn't have no home. Because the home that we call ours, somebody was denying us. And so after the civil war broke out, everybody was displaced. That's why you see we are in America, some are in Canada, some are in London. South Sudanese are all over the world. After we voted, of which majority, myself, for first time, that was my first vote here in the United States. I never voted before. So now we call ourselves South Sudanese. And each and everyone, though we don't have nothing on the ground, it was empty, at least you can build your home. You know, that's mean my parents that are still alive now could build something, or I can help them.
Have you been able to reconnect with your family back in South Sudan?
I haven't been back yet, but my mom's still alive, but she told me some of my siblings are not alive. And my dad was killed in the war.
Do you think that you will be able to go back and see your mom? Or is that something, with all the memories, is that even something you want to do, to go back?
I would want to go back, to go visit. But at current situation that my country is in, I can't do it. You know, it's too dangerous. And maybe down the road in the future, yes, I can go visit.
How do you communicate with your mom?
Through the phone, because she's in the village. She don't have no phone. So what I do is, like, for some of my friends that are living in the city, are the one that I call, and they go get her, to bring them to their house so I can talk to her. But she's in the village. She don't have no access to road, to cell phone or nothing like that.
Has she heard your music?
No.
Do you hope that she can?
I don't think it's going to be easy until I go. But right now, no access.
I mean, if you had to sum up the message of your music, what would it be?
First, I would want the whole world to understand that, you know, a child is born. And when he's born, he had a duty and he had a role to play in the community. So my message of peace, love, togetherness, that's what all my song and what I'm trying to do is about.
So that children can fulfill their roles in their own communities?
Yes, yes. And so That's why I composed a song called We Are One People. I mean, United States, we are one people. If they didn't welcome me, I would have no dream of being a musician or putting my story out there. A story of love, story of appreciation, story of unity, story of togetherness. So with that, love is what made me to be who I am. And it was given by the United States, and I'm very appreciative for that. And I want the whole world to know about that.
We're going to go out on another song. This is a song from your new album. What is this song about?
That song is called Kuwanchating. What you see is not equal to what you did not see. What I'm singing and what I'm talking about is what I see, and I lived it. And so when you pretend to think like, you know, what you heard is more powerful than what you see, and you hear it, and while you're there, I'm saying on the song, no, that's why you see the whole world is in chaos. So let's see it first and hear it, and then now talk about it, just like I'm talking to you. So you see what I'm talking about, and you are listening to it.
Dominic Leek, thank you so much, and congratulations on the new album.
Thank you so much, Yada. I appreciate you having me here, and I'm very grateful. I want to shout out the whole city and the whole family, KCUR family, for giving me opportunity. And Luel Mayen, of course, he's my manager. You know, working with you guys, it was not easy.
Well, Dominic's band is G Dinkus. Their album release party is this coming Saturday, July 14th at 5 p.m. It'll be at the American Sons of Columbus Hall near Columbus Park on Independence Avenue. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for more Central Standard. Housing discrimination and a crunch for affordable housing are major issues we still wrestle with in Kansas City. But back in the 1960s, a woman by the name of Ruth Schechter was fighting those problems tooth and nail. Here are some excerpts from her recent obituary. As a commissioner on the Kansas Commission on Civil Rights, Ruth worked tirelessly for adoption of the Kansas Civil Rights Act. She co-created the Greater Kansas City Housing Information Center, pioneering the provision of housing counseling in Kansas City. And it doesn't say this, but Ruth fought to get the first Black family moved into Fairway in an era when Johnson County was a destination for white flight. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Henry Sewing remembers that moment on a really personal level because he was a child when he moved into that house in partnership with Ruth. Henry, good morning.
Good morning.
So, of course, this is a political moment in Kansas City that we're looking back on. But as a child, I wonder if that's how you felt it.
Yes, at times. I was very young, and I would hear discussions with my parents and when they would talk with Ruth, and we would go to Ruth's house. And so you always heard political discussions then. I didn't understand the magnitude, but yes, we understood then.
What do you remember overhearing?
All kinds of talk about urban renewal. You know, this was a time when Head Start, Fair Housing, and urban renewal were going on. Dr. Martin Luther King had just been assassinated, and so it was basically, quote-unquote, the movement, and I would hear different conversations explaining the different laws that are coming out, fair housing and things like that. Now, I can't tell you specifics about it because I was 4 or 5 years old, but I do remember. I also remember when we moved in Fairway, there were people who protested, and Ruth, I do specifically remember Ruth came through the picket lines and came over to our parents and said, hey, my kids will babysit your kids and they will be safe.
Wow. So take me back to the decision for your family to move to Fairway. Can you talk to me about what you now know about that decision and that, I mean, that was a fight your family was going to be fighting?
Yeah, it wasn't so much a fight, because there's some background information that needs to go with that. I mean, my father was a real estate agent, and not only that, he had built subdivisions in KCK, Brentwood Hills. His uncle was a banker, H.W. Sewing, who had a bank. So the financing, my father knew how to do all these steps that are included when you move into a neighborhood. My father had worked with Ruth, Dr. Manili in Prairie Village, Sam Mann, and all of those all over the city for fair housing in advance of the laws being passed.
So your family, though, had this experience of moving to a neighborhood. You're talking about people were protesting your mm-hmm. arrival there. Mm-hmm. What do you know about the sort of political landscape surrounding housing and desegregation in Kansas City? Because at this point, you know, technically the law of the land.
The tenants.
Right.
Well, I knew that they were tenants, and I knew that, you know, post-World War II, the highways came in, people moved to Johnson County. People in KC moved north and east, Raytown. And I remember my father going and speaking in advance of the Fair Housing Act to talk about fair housing, the impact on the community, and the tenants. You know, some of those tenants weren't even released until 2005 in Kansas City, Missouri. Some of them still exist in the United States. But going back to your question, the political environment you're asking about?
Yeah.
We knew that there were protesters, but for every protester, there were people that came to us at school or parents in PTA where my mom participated, along with Ruth, and these different organizations that were unified for a cause. And, you know, the main cause, the main goal of moving to Johnson County, which Ruth knew, was that Johnson County at that time, excuse me, was the fifth richest county in the United States. Mission Hills, the neighboring city to Fairway, was the third richest city in the United States. And Shawnee Mission schools were considered superior. So that's, my parents were all about education, and I know Ruth was about education. So it was about educational opportunity more than a political statement.
Right. That makes sense. And so Ruth's kids babysat you guys while there were protests going on around your house?
Well, yeah, not only that. I mean, Ruth had her kids. Ruth had a printing press in her basement where she would design material. I remember the printing press going, and her kids would be there helping with those materials, stuffing envelopes, and everything. So a lot of times Ruth's kids would watch us when they were out at forums. They had a lot of forums, like at Village Church in Prairie Village, at different churches where they'd go out and talk about fair housing. And so her kids would watch us while they were at these forums. And these forums got really heated. There were people standing up in churches yelling and cussing, yelling, "What about the children? We don't want race and religious mixing in our communities," and things like that, while we were safe with Ruth's kids at either our house or their house. So that's how that worked.
What do you know about her and what motivated her?
Anybody listening right now probably does not know exactly what motivated her except for her children. But Ruth was tenacious. And she was a true champion of all people. I know that's a cliche now, and you hear it in politics all the time, but she really, really looked out for all people. I think that Ruth's background, growing up in Chicago, and I think she was a musician, and she was so multi-talented. She had a skill set that I don't think you could find now. I mean, she was one of a kind, driven and professional and able to organize many people that still today, like Alvin Brooks, are still out in the community producing positive results.
Do you see her as having a really clear-cut, like, objective kind of legacy here in Kansas City?
Oh, absolutely. And it goes so far beyond fair housing. So far beyond fair housing. I mean, because she was an advisor to all. Like I said, she helped with different communities with urban renewal, help revamp communities out in Olathe. Ruth, I mean, just these Urban Renewal Council, Kansas City Council on Religion and Race, League of Women Voters. She was a champion for women's rights, Project Equality. You know, it wasn't just the housing, but it was the education. We go back to education because a lot of this was about education and not only educating, personal education, but educating the community that these people, all people, could be productive. Because, you know, we go back to the tenets. Those tenets said Jewish, Black, Asian, Arabic, Hispanic were not allowed to move into these neighborhoods. And it was about educating these people in our community, Greater Kansas City, to say that, hey, the people that you're trying to exclude here can really contribute to our community. And if you look back now, the impact of Ruth, look at, we have an African-American mayor and have had multiple African-American mayors. We've had female mayors. I mean, we've had Jewish mayors. I mean, there are a lot of people that have contributed significantly to Greater Kansas City. Johnson County, Blue Springs, Lee Summit, Raymore, Belton. You know, all these different places, North Kansas City, all these different places. I think that's part of Ruth's legacy.
Was it scary for you as a kid to move into a neighborhood where people were protesting your right to be there?
No, our Fairway was awesome. I still, to this day, I had so much fun as a kid. And a lot of it had to do with the swimming pool and the park and the people that we grew up with. It was about the people, and the people were so welcoming. We were on the swim team. We were on different baseball teams.
So wait, who was protesting?
Multiple people from Kansas City. You know, we didn't have protesters until the Kansas City Star and the Wall Street Journal started writing about integration in the suburbs.
Really? What were those articles? What did they say?
Well, they just talked about the Fair Housing Act coming up. And some of them would talk about, part of the Fair Housing Act, there were people that tried to move into areas like Westwood, and the community was, the government officials were accused of trying to raise money to buy these people out. The guy never moved into Westwood. Okay, so they talked about that in the Wall Street Journal. They talked about passing of the laws. They talked about the state of Kansas, when they went to pass the Fair Housing Act, they tried to water down the bill, and Ruth Schechter was there to hound them and make sure that a watered-down version of the bill did not pass. Let's see. I mean, we had just wonderful people, Ruth's kids, and everybody in Fairway. They were really nice.
So it sounds like you had an immediate community of people who were really, like, on board and welcoming and treated you in a really neighborly way, and that it was just a broader kind of audience for these stories that drew people from here and there who came to protest.
Yeah. You know, there was a lot of pre-work done. Okay. Now Ruth and a lot of different committees had the Good Neighbor Pledge that they canvassed all of Kansas City and got 21,000 signatures, but in particular, they got 1,500 signatures in Johnson County that basically was a pledge that people would say, hey, I'm not going to commit violence against these people. I'm going to be neighborly towards these people. There were other meetings that Ruth organized that meet your neighbor, where as soon as someone moved in, you could go and meet your neighbors and have coffee and tea and get to know them.
And so she was still involved with you and your family and what you were doing in this community and what you were doing really for all of Kansas beyond just the moving in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was beyond moving in. I even talked to Ruth about 10 years ago when I was looking at a different house out in Olathe. Now, I didn't end up getting it, but, you know, she said, hey, well, this is a strategy. This is the way you need to line it if you want to get in there.
What was the struggle as far as getting in?
There wasn't really a struggle. It was just some property.
Realty.
It was more business issues.
Yeah.
That there was more business issues than it was about the struggle to get into property. I mean, I don't know. Even though there are tenants and even though housing isn't what it should be, my personal experience was, you know, I built a house 14 years ago in Shawnee, and I was the first person in the subdivision. That would not have happened back in the day when Ruth was fighting for fair housing.
Let's bring Alvin Brooks in on this conversation. Alvin Brooks, good morning.
Good morning to you.
You know, you worked really closely with Ruth Schechter, and the story we've been hearing about Henry Sewing's family moving into Fairway is a story I'm sure you remember well also.
I remember that well, and I wish I could have been on longer today, but I had an emergency out of town, and I'm just driving back in. But let me just say this. Ruth Schechter was an extraordinary woman with a lot of courage. Ruth and I met at the very closely at the Jewish Community Relations Bureau when it was downtown, and Cindy Lawrence was the executive director. So that was back in the 60s. And then Ruth, if there's anyone who was not an attorney dealing in housing or in civil rights, then no one knew any more about housing on both sides of the line, because the situation is the same as with Schechter. And so when Ruth got involved, she was really involved. I remember when Don Sewing moved into Fairway, and I hired Ruth on staff on a contract, and two of the city council persons tried to get me fired. I was director of human relations right after the riot, as part of the director. And they tried to get me fired because they said that troublemaker outsider from the other side of the state who tried that, they had that trouble over there in Kansas. And of course, she was on contract. And the reason why this because.
So wait, can I just clarify this? People were trying to get you fired because you worked with Ruth Schechter, who was considered a troublemaker from the other side of the state line because of her work in fair housing?
That's right. Because of what I had done when I became director of human relations, the fair housing was a committee and not under a department. And I went to the mayor and the city manager. Ike Davis was the mayor, city manager was John Taylor. And I asked them, I said, would you bring that in under the Department of Human Relations? Shouldn't be out there just under a committee. And because that was a mediation, that committee had no power to bring any charges. It was just a mediation committee. And they agreed. And so an ordinance was passed to where the Human Relations Department was responsible for administering that part of the civil rights ordinance. One other thing that should be known is that the fair housing was passed in about January of 1968. But then there was a referendum, which means the tavern owners got together and got enough signatures to have it on the ballot in April of 1968. But then there was a riot, and Ike Davis and his infinite wisdom and leadership was able to get within the city council an emergency measure for the health, safety, and welfare of the community, and it was passed. So after that, that's when I became director and then asked for it to come into the Human Relations Department. Ruth was hired on a contract, and the only reason that and she had to be on a contract because she's not a resident of Kansas City, and no one could work for the city unless they were a resident. And so that's why these two city council persons went to the city manager and said, he needs to be fired because he hired this woman who's a troublemaker.
You know,
after that, go ahead.
Well, I'm curious, does it seem important to you that someone sort of working in the state of Kansas and within the suburbs of Kansas was involved in this fight on the issue of housing and race? Because it seems like with a state line, white flight presents a particular problem in Kansas City, that there's just a whole other set of laws and another set of rules in this separate place.
Oh, yeah, that was true, but I mean, because they were different, but actually the Section 8 of the federal law affected the whole nation, but each state and each city, each jurisdiction could pass its own laws. And so if the person who felt that they were victimized could file a complaint either with the city, the state, or the federal government. The only thing of it is that the city was able to handle the case much more expeditiously because of they didn't have their whole backlog of cases. And keeping in mind that the city was able to work with the persons right there on the scene. So that made the difference. And as I said, Ruth did the training of our investigators, and we had also volunteers because discrimination was there. And what we did, we had what we call the sandwich effect. We trained white couples and black couples to target the four major realtors at that time in the south side of Kansas City, what to them is called the suburbs. They directed black families one way on the 71 highway and white families another way.
Yeah.
So we ended up doing an investigation. Ruth headed that group that was the training and directing them to test.
Alvin, I am so sorry, but we have to go now. I would love to hear more of the story, and maybe we will find a way to do that, but we have to go now. I've got to say thank you to Henry Sewing and Alvin Brooks. Henry, thank you.
Thank you.
And you can listen back or catch anything that you missed at kcur.org/centralstandard. Today's show was produced by Coy Duggar with help from intern Trevor Hook. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next, so don't go away.